Welcome to the fourth installment of the appropriately titled Cleveland State University Psychology Club podcast. I am a member of that psychology club. I am Kevin Jaworski, one of your hosts, joined by...
I'm Madhva Galgali. I too am a member of psychology club. Today we talk with Dr. Yarlowski and Dr. Allard.
Yes. Our first...
guest.
Dual guest episode. And the first time I am told that four people at once were being recorded in this room. So this is a...
landmark episode.
Exactly. But yeah, so Dr. Yaroslavsky, his background is primarily deals with emotion regulation and depression. He runs the Mood and Emotion Regulation Lab here at Cleveland State University. And Dr. Allard also... focuses on emotion regulation in his research, as well as attention and emotion regulation across the lifespan. So
Dr. Yarlowski is your advisor, right?
Yes, he is my research mentor.
Yes. How has it been, as somebody works with the emotion regulation stuff, how has your experience been?
It's been great. I came into his lab personally wanting to go into counseling, and the experience that I've had there has really kind of caused me to take a bit of a left turn to want to go into clinical psychology and focus more on research. As we'll find out, emotion regulation is incredibly... broad topic, and we talk about that in this episode. So it's a great tool with which you can look at many different psychological constructs, psychopathologies.
I think we should also give a disclaimer to our audience. This episode is a little bit more academic than the other ones. We do get into a little bit of nitty-gritties about emotion regulation and various strategies for emotion regulations and stuff like that. So some of that is going to be pretty academic. Although I wouldn't say completely jargon-filled. We try our best not to do that. But yes, it's a little bit more on the academic side.
And I think that there's definitely practical implications for that came about as a result of this conversation.
Yes.
As far as looking at, well, if I'm depressed, what emotion regulation strategies might be useful for me to focus on or engage in? Which is another great thing I think about emotion regulation. You can kind of take these things that if maybe you haven't thought about before, like how I regulate my emotions, what does that mean? What does that look like? What are the outcomes of that? And say, hey, can I sort of tinker with this and try different things and have a different everyday experience?
Thinking from a non-psychology person perspective, taking my psychology hat off, we think of emotions as something that happens to us. We never construe of emotions as something that we can actively control and regulate. And that's an eye-opening part for me in the podcast. As soon as we understand that we can intervene and choose how to look into that experience and as a consequence affect what type of emotions we feel and the ways in which we can do that is something I think that's going to be very helpful for people listening to this.
Yeah, and that's something I've kind of forgotten about, and that's a really interesting point. I remember posting on social media once something about something I was doing here, and it had something to do with emotion regulation, and somebody responded, what is emotion regulation, and is there a class I can take in this, or something to that effect. So I think it's something that, people hear that, and they're kind of like, oh, wait a minute, I can actively participate in this?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
You should track that person down and send him this podcast.
I will. enough from us, and we turn it over to Dr. Yaroslavsky and Dr. Allard.
Yes, thank you guys for having us.
Thank you.
So one thing that is similar across both of your research interests is emotion regulation. So for those of us who are not very sure of what that means, what is emotion regulation and how it affects our daily life? It's an open question. both of you can answer it. So you can.
I guess the first thing to say is, what isn't emotion regulation? You know, so one thing that's really interesting about understanding emotions in general, you know, emotions themselves have a very interesting definable nature, and then trying to define a regulation from that can be a little tricky too. But a lot of researchers and theorists will argue that emotion regulation, broadly conceived, is basically the means by which we influence the emotions we have, when we have them, to what extent, and the ways that we express them. Okay, so that's like a very broad, generalized term for emotion regulation. But it can involve a variety of different kind of methods for regulation. You can be regulating your physiological state. You can regulate the subjective experience, or how you kind of like cognitively evaluate, the emotions that you're having, or the ones that others are having, and then also the expression of those emotions. So like facial expression, bodily expression, things like that.
And so both of you use this paradigm of thinking in different areas of research. You use that mostly in clinical settings, while you use that in aging settings. So how does that work out, and how does this thinking about emotion regulation help in clinical settings and in aging settings?
Sure, so I'll jump in. So one thing I might add to what Dr. Aller defined emotion regulation as being is it's really the up or down regulation of any emotion, and it could be in the form of upregulation, its intensity, its duration, as well as the opposite, reducing it, and both intensity and duration wise. So in clinical psychology, we typically think of emotional disorders, those ranging from various anxiety disorders, depression, as well as, frankly, personality and other disorders, as being ones where emotions are running wild. Right. So with anxiety, individuals anticipate something terrible happening. They're worrying about something that hasn't yet happened, or they're experiencing intense physiological sensations, such as those associated with fear. Either way, those are emotional states. And while we all have emotions, for those who experience an emotional disorder, typically the emotions are impairing, or at least behaviors associated with those emotions stop the person from being able to fully engage in their life and do the things that they would need to do. So when it comes to emotion regulation, to me, and I think to a number of colleagues in my field, it seems to be at the heart of many disorders. One of the potential issues that we face, though, is the definition of emotion regulation. As Dr. Aller alluded, it can range across various levels of abstraction. So you could think about your neurological changes, various activation and pathways as being part of emotion regulation, or some have argued it's part of emotion generation, so the actual experience of the emotional state. There frankly is no clear agreement about what point does an emotion come on versus to the point where it becomes to be regulated. Because if really emotion regulation is anything that alters any aspect of an emotional state, for example, its occurrence or lack of thereof, surely then the generation process is really entangled with the emotion regulation process. And you can think about physiological responses. Are they part of the emotional experience itself? Are they efforts of your body to automatically regulate it? And subsequent behavioral and other cognitive responses that might engender the intensification or reduction of an emotional state. That's a long-winded answer to say that I think that many of my colleagues agree emotion regulation is seminal to the onset and recurrence of many disorders.
And what about aging?
Yeah, so we take a more of a kind of well-being perspective in the context of emotions and emotion regulation in an aging context, mostly in terms of healthy emotional functioning. And the reason for this is because, a lot of research in the psychology of human aging kind of focused in its early years, even before it was an identifiable field, on like how things decline as we get older. Like there's, you know, pervasive changes and downturns in cognitive functioning, physical health. But in the last, you know, 15 to 20 years or so, we've started to understand that, well, you know, development is a much more of a kind of nuanced proposition. And, you know, we're continuing to grow and mature, improvements, declines, and maintenance in a variety of domains. Well, what we found, you know, a couple decades ago is that one domain where we actually might see maintenance and improvement is in the context of emotional processing and regulation. In spite of this kind of, you know, doom and gloom narrative of growing older, older adults actually reported, if you were to, you know, assess them on kind of, you know, surveys of their current emotional states, level of happiness, level of kind of distress, that they're reporting being pretty happy and feeling pretty good. And so this was kind of a shock to a lot of researchers, presuming that aging was this kind of time of decline. And so researchers have gone out to try to say, like, well, what is it that is going on with people as they get older that is leading them to live these positive, effective lives? And it turns out that there could be a variety of motivational or experience-based mechanisms that are leading older adults to be feeling pretty good and being pretty happy. And so what researchers have examined is like, well, what are older adults doing when they're confronted with a variety of emotional elicitors, you know, whether it's, you know, negative life events, you know, confrontations with social partners, dealing with aspects of, you know, strain and stress in their daily lives, that they're actually implementing effective strategies in order to maintain high levels of well-being. And so a lot of my research and my colleagues in this area of understanding well-being trajectories as we get older have taken this frame to see, like, well, what are the ways that people as they get older are modulating their emotional experiences in order to, you know, produce high levels of positive affect and diminishment and negative affect. So we take kind of this, you know, healthy gain-based viewpoint for understanding, you know, as we get older, this might be one area that we become pretty savvy in, is modulating and managing our emotional experiences in order to, you know, benefit our present well-being.
That's it. You mentioned emotion regulation being something that's common to, or that impairments in that are common to many psychopathologies. So in depression, what are some differences in somebody who is depressed and how they're regulating their emotions versus somebody who's not and what they're doing?
Sure. So with depression, what we find is that it's a disorder marked by dysphoria. So people who get depressed oftentimes report feeling sad or down, and that feeling sticks around day in and day out for multiple weeks at a time. Excuse me. They also report some amount of difficulty upregulating some of their emotional states, such as they report deficits in pleasure. They may experience pleasure when something good happens, but it doesn't seem to last for them. And so arguably depression is an issue of two forms of emotion regulation, the difficulty in downregulating distress or dysphoric feelings, and also upregulating kind of hedonic experiences, those that maybe you or I, when we experience it, it lasts for us. And so interventions accordingly have tried to target both when they target emotion regulation deficits. With respect to maybe the main problem with depression, the literature seems to by and large show that responses that generally are seen as ineffective or maladaptive are being deployed more readily by those individuals who either are depressed now or have been depressed, or by virtue of familial and other factors are at increased risk to experience a depressive episode. So in a way, maybe the problem is not do they regulate their emotions, but are they doing so effectively and through responses that would seem to be less detrimental in the long term versus not.
One thing I wanted to ask, maybe Dr. Allard, you would be interested in answering this question, is are there any cultural differences that we see in emotion regulation? Is it possible that people from different cultures have learned to regulate their emotions differently? And I mean, as somebody who's come from different culture, I have seen some of that, but I'm not sure. Is it just me or is it a cultural thing? So
no, it's not just you. Yes, there are a wide variety of cultural differences in terms of not just emotional experience, but also regulation. So one thing that, you know, comes up with trying to look at cross-cultural differences in kind of emotionality in general is, you know, display rules, for instance. Like, there's different cultural differences in terms of, you know, what types of emotions people are more or less willing to express, you know, given the context. So just to give you an example, you know, from work, you know, related to stuff that I do, is there's kind of like this demarcation between like individualistic versus collectivistic cultures. So individualistic cultures, ones that have more of a, you know, I'm the agent of kind of my life, and I, you know, I'm the individual who, you know, exerts influence on my environment, and the desire is to kind of like do benefit for myself, you know. Relative to a collectivistic culture where it's more like, well, I'm part of a broader, you know, social group where my kind of wants and desires sometimes can be, you know, subjugated underneath the roles and goals of a group. So sometimes what you'll see is that, you know, certain emotions like happiness and joy and exuberance tend to have more of like a individualistic component where, you know, individualistic cultures will express those more readily, or they'll be kind of, how should I say, more appropriate in those contexts. Whereas kind of like individualistic joy and exuberance might be kind of subverted a little bit in more collectivistic cultures, where you need to be more in tuned to the group context in order to determine what sort of emotions are going to be more appropriate. So, and then also emotions that are desire to maintain interpersonal harmony. You know, so those are going to be the emotions that individuals will tend to pursue or tend to have. And there is some literature suggesting that kind of the expression of those emotions are a little bit different across those two cultures. But then also the ability to recognize emotions kind of vary a little bit, where kind of external context states are going to be more utilized by individuals from a more collectivist culture to understand what's being displayed in that emotional context, whereas like the target of who's displaying the emotion outside of the context is going to be more drawn to make those determinations in a more individualistic context. And that can also influence, you know, the types of regulatory strategies that people would employ as well.
That's interesting.
To kind of follow up what Dr. Allard mentioned, so some of my work has examined cross-cultural differences between individuals of U.S. backgrounds, or maybe more traditional Western backgrounds, versus those of various East and South Asian backgrounds. And what we were finding is that depending on your culture, there are some norms that Dr. Allard has identified, for example, display rules. But in addition to that, there's perhaps some evidence that what in the U.S. we kind of find traditionally to be a maladaptive response, such as avoiding, right? Not really engaging with the problem, not trying to deal with the problem, is actually effective for individuals of some cultural backgrounds, with the degree to which effective actually being influenced by the level of acculturation that an individual who was born, let's say, in a Middle Eastern area of the world coming to the States, they may receive less harm from deploying maybe an avoidant response that in that culture is normative. But as they acquire more of a Western U.S. identity, settling that response gains the value that it has in our culture. It becomes more problematic.
Oh, that's interesting. We were yesterday debating whether there would be any cultural differences in emotion regulations, because it just seems so universal to have emotions, and it would seem that the way people would also use emotion regulation would be more or less along the same lines across cultures. But
that gets to an interesting debate about kind of defining emotions. You know, there are certain researchers, so you go back to like the 60s and 70s, like Darwin, Paul Ekman, who would say like, yeah, there are these universal emotional constructs like happy, sadness, anger, fear. They have identifiable expressions. They have identifiable like physiological profiles, and also identifiable elicitors and like action tendencies, like, you know, happy leads to this kind of behavioral profile. Sadness leads to this kind of behavioral profile. And you know, there's lots of data suggesting that if you kind of, you know, look at cultures that have not been really touched by outside influences, they might not have the same kind of language for emotion that we have, but at least they understand the concepts of those basic emotions. But then more recent theories have argued that, like, well, emotional experience is more of a cognitive construction. There aren't really these universal states, but it's just like, you know, levels of pleasantness and unpleasantness and high and low arousal. And we, based on our culture and our environment and our context, we ascribe labels and kind of schemas to these emotional states that could be rooted in our cultural context. So the way that we experience emotion, the way we regulate emotion, could be very, you know, culture specific rather than more universal. And there's, you know, decades worth of debate as to whether this basic emotion versus more of a, you know, circumspect model of emotion is what wins out. And you can provide evidence in some cases for both.
That's interesting.
It's probably fair to say that there are some responses that are cross-culturally maybe maladaptive. So, for instance, self-harm.
Yeah.
Probably not the most effective thing that you can do in the long term, irrespective of your country of origin. However, those responses that are particularly social in nature, such as suppressing your expression of emotions, may be more culturally salient, may have more cultural relativity.
This just leads me to an interesting thing. You mentioned self-harm. Some of the rituals that are involved in some other cultures, they actually involve self-harm. And that's the way sometimes the individuals within those cultures, they get permission to enter whatever group that they were born into. And it's like a ritual kind of a thing. So, and that is a very emotional period for the individual also, but for the families of that individual, because they're being accepted as a legitimate member of the group in which they're born into. So do you think even in that context it would be harmful or something like that?
Well, I think there's a difference between what you describe and emotion regulation, as at least I'm thinking about it. You're describing a ritual that is a rite of passage, essentially, of one individual entering into a different social group. But it sounds like that ritualized behavior is fairly circumscribed, right, to that ceremony, however long it lasts. When I think about emotion regulation, I think about your habitual or usual responses.
Yes.
So if your go-to thing when you're upset is to burn yourself, cut yourself, things of that nature, maybe the rigidity of that response is what's going to lead to the problem.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I want to come back to depression. You had mentioned briefly suppression as being something, but there's a large body of literature that suggests that if someone's depressed, they're probably ruminating a bit. Is it fair to say that if, let's say I'm depressed, like I'm ruminating, but just because I'm ruminating, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm depressed though? Like, what's like the way to think about that?
That's, I think, a fair statement. So I suspect that if we take a moment and think about the last week or couple of weeks, and we really are self-critical without being judgmental, we could probably find times where we maybe dwelled on something, where we said, why did this happen? And what are the implications of this? And did I want this to happen? And how do I feel about it? So rumination, what I just described, is a fairly universal phenomena. The problems arise when people ruminate for extended periods of time, and it's a habitual act. So whenever a negative emotional state comes on, something bad happens, something you don't like happens, you start really kind of dwelling about it, and that's your go-to thing. Because we know from large body of literature, rumination maintains and intensifies your negative emotional state. So it's associated with depression for that reason, if no other.
So it's looked at as an attempt to regulate emotion based on, let's say, like a negative event that's happened or a negative interpretation of an event. But if it maintains negative feeling, then I guess the question is, like, why regulate your emotions like that?
So I would say people who ruminate, and there's some evidence to support this, believe that when I'm ruminating, it's actually helping me to deal with the problem because I'm thinking about it, and I perceive this is a productive activity. So the intention of these maladaptive responses is not to fail at changing how you feel. You're working towards maybe finding a solution, but the path that's being taken is not an effective one, which is why we'd consider it a maladaptive response, because in the long term, it's not going to make you feel better.
And that's how you define kind of the two ways, because there's like these two ways of rumination, right? So the first, as Dr. Y was saying, it's like a reflective rumination, where you're thinking about, okay, why did this happen? What could have I done differently? Oh, here's kind of an adaptive tactic I could take the next time that this happens or something. But then the brooding piece, which is that perseverative, protracted, kind of self-critical, like, oh, I screwed up. Don't know why I screwed up. I'm terrible. On and on and on. That's the maladaptive piece. So like rumination in of itself is not always negative. You know, the examination piece, like the self-reflective piece, can be very adaptive because, you know, the unexamined, you know, faults would be also problematic for us. We'd be keep making the same mistakes over and over again. Mm-hmm. But when you get into that protracted, very long-term self-criticism, that's the problematic context.
Although it's interesting, what Dr. Allard says is absolutely true, and yet the literature seems to suggest this role of reflection, this kind of critical evaluation of oneself, variably a good thing.
It's a mixed bag.
It is absolutely a mixed bag.
And I wanted to ask, so is the intent in either case, whether it's some kind of constructive self-reflection versus a maladaptive brooding, is the intent the same in either case? But it's just, well, if I'm depressed and I have all the things that go into making somebody depressed, it manifests as rumination, whereas if I'm not depressed, that same intent manifests as a more of a constructive self-reflection, or I'm more able to do that.
You know, it's not as clear-cut of a picture. We know that people ruminate whether or not they're in a depressed state. There is likely some evidence that when someone is in a depressed state, that maybe their tendency to ruminate will increase. It certainly is true for other maladaptive responses. So those with depression histories, for example, tend to report wider or broader repertoires of various responses that we generally think aren't effective in the long term. But they start to do more of those maladaptive things when in the midst of depression. At least that's what they say they do. So is rumination one where you're brooding when you're depressed, you're reflecting when you're not? Probably not. You're probably still, if you have a tendency to brood, are brooding when you're not depressed. Maybe just doing more of that when you are in a particularly distressed emotional state, like depression oftentimes brings about. So I think it's really messy. We're not sure if it's really reflection when you're not depressed versus becoming more sinister when you are.
Yeah, I might even think of it as, like, if we just took, rather than one person in different states, like, just two different people. Like, one tends to be depressed, one doesn't. Is the one that doesn't tend to be depressed, just kind of doing more reflecting. And
I think that's a good question. I don't think the evidence is clear enough to make that determination, unfortunately. But
I suppose, in a way, you're dovetailing reflection with the idea of mindfulness. If we think about mindfulness as being a kind of an unjudgmental reflection or awareness of your thoughts, your tendencies, and things that come up for you, perhaps the difference being that with reflection, it's an intentional focus on something that maybe occurred, and you're thinking about why it occurred, versus mindfulness just, I guess by some definitions, allowing those thoughts to come up without trying to hold on to them or to push them aside.
So for the person that's ruminating, is it more like they're like that mindfulness piece isn't there and they're just sort of like lost in the story that like they're telling themselves about like what has happened and the implications for it and what it says about them? And
I would say so, because again, if we think of mindfulness as this non-judgmental stance where you're allowing thoughts, ideas, images, and feelings to arise on their own and you observe them and not hold on to them. By definition, when you're brooding, you are holding on to something, and almost like the physiological act of rumination, you're regurgitating that thought again and again and again. So one could almost say that brooding is antithetical to a mindful state, at least by some definitions of what mindfulness is.
So are there some strategies people who tend to ruminate a lot can use to make themselves ruminate less?
Absolutely.
So what could be some of those strategies?
So there are a number of empirically supported practices, I suppose, that help people to ruminate less. In fact, some interventions for depression are geared towards rumination. The most basic, I suppose, response is to refocus their attention. So brooding is inherently a cognitive process where you are thinking about an event and going through mental gymnastics with it. Refocusing your attention to something as tangible as, let's say, the table around which we're sitting refocuses your attention from the cognitive abstract to a concrete experience, whether it's sensory nature and across various sensations. It still is a refocusing of attention. So if you're able to shift your attention away from this cognitive stuff to something more concrete like this table, so I'm putting my hand on this table, and I close my eyes, and I'm noticing its temperature, I'm noticing its texture, and I can really focus my attention on it. I'm no longer thinking about whatever I was brooding about. So that has been actually a very effective strategy that Jacobson and others employed when they were looking at the difference between behavioral activation or behavioral therapy versus cognitive behavioral therapy in some studies that they did in the past.
So are there any differences across lifespans when it comes to rumination? Is there any literature showing that older people tend to ruminate less or more or something like that?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. There's not a ton of literature that I'm familiar with, at least in like non-clinical contexts of a tendency to ruminate. Now, there has been a little bit of recent literature coming out suggesting that older adults might actually engage in more dispositional, mindful awareness type, you know, kind of mental states than younger adults do. So, for instance, there's been a couple of studies recently that came out that one way, you know, so I went back, I was talking about earlier how aging might be related to kind of improved, you know, affectivity, like improved hedonic positive affect, decreases in negative affect reports. And there was one study that found that dispositional use of mindfulness tendencies through like a self-report assessment did provide at least partial mediation for the age affect relationship, with higher age, lower negative affect, partially mediated by a tendency to be more mindful at older ages. And then they also found in a separate study this association with positive affect as well. So again, if like rumination, like Dr. Yaroslavsky was saying, is kind of antithetical to like these brooding ruminative tendencies, and older adults are engaging in more mindful awareness just in their kind of day-to-day, you know, activities, that they may have less of a tendency to ruminate or brood in some cases. But in terms of like the empirical literature looking at age rumination associations, that's something that I'm not too familiar with, but at least I could probably speculate that they're less likely to be. Mm-hmm. And also additional links to that are if you look at kind of rates of, you know, emotion regulation disorders, anxiety disorders, depression disorders, those tend to be rates are lower at older ages, at least in community dwelling older adult populations. So just the mere fact that they're typically suffering less from these types of issues would indicate that they're less likely to be engaging in these problematic ruminative strategies.
So I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about attention disengagement, because it sounds like that's central to the issue of regulating one's emotions. If you are ruminating, let's say, it's like the inability to stop ruminating or the perceived inability. And both of you published a paper together recently in which you looked at attention disengagement and how rumination might moderate that relationship to depression. And I was wondering if you guys could like talk a little bit about your findings.
Sure, happy to. So this work, along with Alvaro Sanchez Duran
Lopez,
thank you. He's married, and I butchered his last name now. We were looking at this disengagement hypothesis that a gentleman by the last name of Koester put out there. And the premise is fairly straightforward. So people who ruminate tend to more or less attend to their cognitive thoughts, right? And it's kind of like a snowball effect for individuals who tend to ruminate. So something comes on, an event occurs, or they start to think about a prior event that was maybe negative in nature. And they start to think about it, their emotions kind of build, they start to feel more upset, because when you think about upsetting things, it's normal to feel upset. And they tend to think even more. And so it kind of, in a way, spirals out of control for these individuals. Which begs the question, do folks who tend to ruminate have maybe subtle attentional deficits? So they have a harder time refocusing their attention. Hmm. Perhaps. Hence this attention disengagement hypothesis. Is it the subtle attention deficits that lead to rumination that in turn rumination exploits and makes attention flexibility less available? So our work involved an eye tracking paradigm that measured the speed with which individuals were able to shift their attention from two faces, same actor, one of the actor's valences or emotional expressions was neutral, and the other one was either reflecting a sad affect, a happy affect, or a disgusted facial expression. And we measure attention disengagement as the time it took the participant from after time they looked at, let's say, a sad face, it took them to shift their attention towards a neutrally valenced expression of that same actor. The idea being that our attention is not free of bias. We gravitate towards some information more readily than others. Mm. And for individuals who maybe have a hard time disengaging their attention, especially when it comes to rumination, maybe they have a hard time going away from negative information, such as that which is conveyed on the face. So our index of attention disengagement involved the time it took to shift their attention away from sad faces to neutral faces, and also from happy faces to neutral faces, because depression, again, is an issue of both sadness, dysphoria, as well as positive emotions. And there's evidence that there are various sorts of biases that are associated with both types of stimuli for depressed persons. I'll let Dr. Allard take it away from here.
Yeah, of course. And to kind of get back to that kind of that inherent bias, a lot of this work started to try to disentangle, like, well, if there are these kind of attentional control deficits, is it a problem with just being, you know, geared towards the, like, negative, especially in the context of depression-relevant information? So you're just geared toward it. It's very salient. It's just going to pop out for you, okay? And that sort of bias is what's kind of linked to kind of this depressive symptomology, rather than disengagement, where, you know, once it captures attention, it pulls you in and you can't pull away. Because we would argue that, you know, from an adaptive sense, survival sense, we should be vigilant to a variety of pieces of information in the environment. Okay. So, you know, be vigilant to threats, be vigilant to, you know, anything that could be of potential value. So, like, the initial capture of attention from piece of information is probably good for all of us. If we were completely ignorant of kind of those salient sources, that could be problematic. But once that information captures attention and it's no longer relevant, it's not useful for you to keep engaging with that information, then pulling away is what's going to be adaptive. Okay. And so that's, you know, and some of the earlier work prior to this attention disengagement hypothesis found that in a variety of studies where you saw that, you know, individuals with either depression histories or dysphoric states or whatever, both in clinical and non-clinical samples, it wasn't that they were showing these initial biases in attention, it's that it took longer for these biases to emerge. So it's indicating that individuals, it took some time for them to kind of show this preference and maybe a problem with pulling away from it. And so with our results, what we actually found was that individuals who took longer to shift their attention away from those sad faces and were quicker to shift their attention away from the happy, so they weren't engaging with the pleasant, kind of hedonically oriented information more, actually this was linked to higher rates of depression symptomology from, like, a depression questionnaire, and also linked to higher negative affective reports, lower positive affective reports over a subsequent week outside of the lab.
Okay.
And this was mediated by ruminative tendencies.
Okay.
So more greater rumination, linking to these depressive symptomologies and then kind of these negative affective experiences outside of the lab, leading to this link between kind of the attentional control deficit to negative affective outcomes through this ruminative tendency. And the rumination was, you know, also a self-reported kind of assessment. We also had some other measures of kind of experiencing negative affect due to a lab-based elicitor, and then also a subsequent attentional refocusing task to see if, you know, kind of depression history or higher depression rates would be related to kind of a problems with attentional refocusing after actually engaging in a self-relevant sadness elicitor. That's something that we haven't analyzed yet. We'll go back to that in a little bit, but at least it gave some, you know, key evidence for this impaired disengagement hypothesis that these attentional control difficulties are linked to depression-relevant outcomes through probably these ruminative type tendencies.
And something to note, so this was a study was conducted with a sample of individuals who have never been depressed, so we'll call them controls, mm-hmm. and those who have depression histories. And what we found was that this disengagement difficulty was what you can consider independent of those histories, meaning it didn't matter if you have a history of depression or not in predicting where you are now in terms of your attention engagement. We also saw that this deficit was not related to how you were feeling just before you started this disengagement task. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing then, it's state independent in some ways, mm-hmm. right? It's not affected by your immediate mood, and it's not affected by your prior history. I'll also say this. Since that study, some work in my lab has examined processes for depression risk transmission within families. And so we had parents, moms particularly, come in and bring their adolescent offspring. So their kiddos were between the ages of 12 and just shy of 18. And among other things that we did, we had them do this attention disengagement task that Dr. Allard and I published a manuscript on. And our findings were really interesting. First, we replicated in these youths that those who had a harder time disengaging from sadness and were faster to engage from positive emotionality valence faces had higher depression levels. So we had now replication with kids who are not depressed, but who maybe have a risk for depression, and those who don't, by virtue of not having a parent with a history of depression. We also found that if you follow these kids out for about 8 days, and you kind of measure times where they feel some amount of upset feelings. So we asked them about how they're feeling at the moment, as well as tell us about a time that you felt more upset, if there was such a time in the past hour. And then if they said, yeah, I was upset more, we asked them, what did you do about those feelings, including rumination being one of those responses. What we found was that difficulty disengaging from sad faces and a fast disengagement from positively valence faces predicted what kids actually did when they were upset in their daily lives. And in turn, their use of rumination predicted more protracted dysphoria from the time they felt most upset during the past hour and the moment where they're completing the survey. So we actually have replicated and extended the findings with the adult sample, those with and without depression histories, to a higher sample of adolescents.
So just as a takeaway, I would am I right in thinking that people who tend to be depressed have a harder time disengaging from things that are sad because their attention kind of makes them shift and focus towards things that are sad or that might be, let's say, that might downregulate their mood or something like that?
You know, it's an interesting question. The logic would say, yes, that's probably true. I'm not sure if we have sufficient empirical evidence to put a flag there yet. And I say this because there have been a number of studies of rumination. This construct has been around for quite some time. But what we typically see is that rumination is associated with depression symptoms. So you're more elevated in your depression levels if you tend to ruminate. It predicts depression over time, both with respect to change in the trajectories of depression. So maybe you don't have clinical depression, you can't be diagnosed, but you have elevated symptoms. And also some evidence suggests that if you tend to ruminate, when you are depressed, you'll stay depressed for longer. There are relatively fewer works that show that rumination predicts first incidence of depression. So you've never been depressed, but you ruminate a lot, and now we can predict you're going to become depressed.
Yeah.
In the thousands of articles that have examined rumination, there are only a handful that do that. And also in terms of predicting depression recurrence, so you have been depressed, and now we're trying to predict whether you'll become depressed again. These are important questions to ask because they would help us to clarify just what you were getting at. Is it that when you ruminate, it more or less upregulates your distress, and that's what gets you to be depressed?
Okay.
Another question too is like thinking of like which of these processes kind of like come before the other, or mm-hmm. is it like a combination? So one could argue, so like in our models we're saying, well, the attentional control deficit might be predicting kind of the ruminative tendency, but is it the ruminative tendency that's related, is more driving the attentional control deficit, and which is the driving force here? So there's like the causal links are still in need of being identified. And then to the extent how robust is like this attentional control issue really like a good trait level marker for these downstream consequences? Like can you, you know, because then that would have implications for saying like, well, if you, like Dr. Alsosky was saying, is like, well, if you tell people to refocus, maybe that's like the smoking gun. So you try to get people to, you know, refocus their attention either through external sources or internal sources. But then again, is that, you know, the ideal would be like, okay, is that, you know, sufficient for allaying some of these problems? Well, you don't know yet. Because like one would say like, okay, let's just go train people's attention. Good to go. Not that simple.
I just wanted to say that those who are out listening, the way Dr. Allard and Dr. Jaroslawski both summarized their research, that's something to learn for 5 minutes thesis research. It's like within 5 minutes, you guys give a very fantastic snapshot of the research that you just published. That was something that maybe somebody can learn how to summarize their entire complicated research in like 5 minutes.
Thank you. Very kind.
I'm curious about if you guys have any thoughts on this, but my figures could be slightly off, but if I remember correctly, if you've had a major depressive episode, the likelihood that you'll have another one is around 50%.
And then higher.
Basically, the idea being that, and then if you've had two, the likelihood that you'll have a third goes up even more.
Depends. So the literature is rather mixed about whether having multiple depressive episodes predispose you disproportionately for having a subsequent episode than having one episode. We do know that the majority of people will recover from depression in excess of certainly 75-80%. We also know that quite a few, an X of 70-75%+, will experience a subsequent depressive episode at some point in their lives. So just to kind of validate what you were saying, if you get depressed, the odds are you'll get depressed again, although that risk may not be greater for those who have more depressive episodes in their history than less.
So for the people that, let's say, don't get depressed again or get experience depressive episodes as often, are those people, through some means or another, learning how to effectively regulate their emotions in the interim, or is that like?
That's a good question, and frankly, we don't know. We are not great at predicting risk for second, third depressive episodes. Certainly, we're not great at predicting your first incidence of depression. There have only been a handful of studies, surprisingly, that have looked at the relationship between emotion regulation and subsequent depression episodes, so depressive recurrence. One publication from Maria Kovacs' lab, who's a well-known depression researcher, particularly among juniors, adolescents, and pediatric depression, seems to suggest that people who don't get depressed again, assuming they've had a prior depressive episodes, tend to do less of the maladaptive stuff. So the stuff that doesn't work in the long term, it could mean rumination, it could mean avoidance, right? Watching Netflix rather than getting to that homework assignment that you have to do. It could mean using drugs as a way of escaping. There are a number of maladaptive responses across cognitive, interpersonal, and behavioral domains if people engage. But the good stuff, the stuff that we think should work, like thinking about a situation in a different way, becoming engaged with life and behaviorally activated, seeking friends for social support and really kind of either in an instrumental fashion seeking help or just kind of letting your emotional, you know, feelings out. That seems to matter less. So it's not the good stuff that you're doing that matters. It's the bad stuff that you're doing that seems to predict whether you get depressed again or not and how quickly you get depressed.
And that also works in the lab too, right? So like people with a history of depression can come in and do the strategies, like the adaptive strategies in the lab. The problem is that that's not overriding the tendency to do the negative strategies that aren't helpful.
Well, it's interesting. So there is a preponderance of evidence suggests that if you get someone into a laboratory setting and either they already feel upset or you make them feel upset and you give them something to do, that they typically can do a pretty good job. And so whether they're in the midst of a depressive episode or they're not, you can help them to feel better. And oftentimes the outcomes are the same for those who are depressed now and those who have never been depressed in terms of how well they can benefit from what you do. It's not clear whether that, I guess, benefit is related to the bad things that they're doing outside of the lab. So we're not sure. Although there is one publication that I co-authored with Maria Kovacs that seemed to suggest that if you have dispositional tendencies to engage in maladaptive responses, you actually benefit more if someone tells you, do this good thing. But it's unclear whether how well you do in the lab predicts outside. The bad things that you're doing outside. With a caveat, it does predict the good things that you're doing and how well those good things seem to do for you as a function of your depression history. And that's some of the work that I'm in the process of writing up for dissemination, which I think is quite interesting.
So you both mentioned the work that is being done in the lab, and both of your labs uses eye tracking technology. So can you both touch upon how that is helpful in understanding the type of research that you do and informing the type of research that you guys do?
I guess I'll go first because I cannot claim expertise in eye tracking paradigms. That's Dr. Aller's domain, and I'm just learning. But the primary way that we have employed eye tracking has been to index attention biases, so where your attention's drawn and the nature of the stimuli to which it's drawn, to measure attentional disengagement. So if you're asked to shift your attention because the task requires it, can you do it, and how quickly can you do it? And finally, we've looked at the eye tracker as a tool for measure autonomic nervous system responses in a very, very short time frame. So what some people would consider pupillometry, or the way that your pupil dilates within milliseconds of a stimulus coming on board, usually if the stimulus is emotional in nature. And so that's the primary way that we've employed the eye tracker for attention engagement indices and disengagement indices, as well as sympathetic arousal indices.
Yeah, and the main reason we use eye tracking is mostly because of its improvements upon other kind of like standard behavioral measures for indexing attentional biases. So in addition to looking at these kind of biases in attention, but attention in of itself is considered an emotion regulation strategy. The things that you choose to engage with, the things you choose to avoid, can also give us an indication of kind of how you're kind of managing your emotional state by shifting your kind of point of gaze to see what you see is influencing how you feel, or what you avoid is influencing how you feel. But more so in the context of understanding kind of differences in biases, this eye tracking provides a kind of near real-time assessment of what someone is actually processing in the moment. So prior studies, even like in the context of looking at biases and depression, used kind of more reaction type measures like dot probe tasks, or even like emotional Stroop type tasks. So a dot probe task, just briefly, is basically you present, a she said, like, usually paired images or words that are emotional in nature, neutral in nature, or kind of some combination therein. And what you do here is that you randomly, so you present the stimuli on the screen, like paired images, let's say, for like, let's say like 3 seconds, okay? And then after that 3 seconds, there's going to be a dot that will appear in one of the locations of where the images or words were displayed. And you make responses to those dots, determine like some kind of response, whether it's left or right location, or if there's one dot or two dots, or some kind of discriminatory response. And the assumption is that if you're quicker to respond to those probes, it means that you are likely paying attention more to the image that was presented in the same location as that probe. Okay, so like, let's say in a sample looking at kind of biases and depression, if individuals with depression history, if there was like a sad face, for instance, you know, presented in the same location as that probe, and you're really quick to respond to that, that would indicate like, oh, you're showing this bias for this, you know, particular stimulus. The problem with that measure is that all it can really tell you about how attention was being deployed is basically those moments right before the probe appeared. Okay. You have no idea where people were engaging their intention during that entire 3 seconds that those images or words or whatever were being displayed. With eye tracking, you can.
You can
be looking, you know, are they shifting their attention between the two? Are they looking more at one at the other? You know, that you can get throughout the entire time course of a stimulus presentation. But with things like, like an emotional stroop, for instance, if you're more, you know, have more difficulty naming color words that are emotional that aren't, the emotional information is distracting you and you're engaging, like your attention is being engaged that way. But again, that's all happening internally. You don't really know how someone is actually engaging like overt attention during that particular task. And so eye tracking can give us that assessment, and we can use it to, you know, examine deployment with a variety of different stimuli, a variety of different types of contexts. And we don't even have to give anybody any sort of, you know, task that's above and beyond paying attention to the emotional information. We can just say, view this information and let's see where your attention falls. Or we give you instructions to regulate or modulate your responses. How does that influence what you attend to?
Are there any theories about why, like as you had mentioned, the adaptive strategies seem to work in the lab even if somebody has been, you know, activated in a negative way, or they do have a history of depression, or they're depressed, but then it doesn't seem to translate into everyday life?
I don't think there are formal theories about it. Not that I have come across. Although my current thinking on the matter is that what we're seeing is the benefit of a well-controlled environment and a well-structured situation taking place. So what we typically have are individuals who are depressed or are at risk for depression saying that they do a lot of maladaptive things outside of the lab. There's some question about whether or not they're doing fewer adaptive things. So on self-report measures, sometimes you see differences among those various depression backgrounds in terms of their dispositional use of adaptive responses, but other times you don't, and other times you find that the differences are in a completely opposite way, whereby those who are at risk for depression say they're doing more adaptive things than those who are not at risk, or at least at lower risks. But as mentioned, if you take them to the lab and you have them do an adaptive response, typically they do pretty well, with some variation depending on the nature of what you're asking them to do. The few studies that looked at what's happening during those emotion regulation opportunities, what we would call instructed emotion regulation, when you ask someone to do something that's presumably adaptive, is that, for example, if you ask someone who's at risk for depression to recall a pleasant memory and talk about it in great detail, which we would call positive iconographical memory, and it's one emotion regulation strategy, is thought to be adaptive, they require more prompting from the experimenter. So there's more of an effort made by the environment to improve basically the result of the individual who is deploying the adaptive response. And so it begs the question, well, are we seeing these good outcomes in the lab as a true lack of a skills deficit, meaning essentially there's no difference in how well people who are depressed, not depressed, are able to deploy these emotion regulation responses that are adaptive in nature? Or are we seeing maybe kind of a deceptive finding where perhaps the better they do in the lab heralds a vulnerability for depression among those who are currently depressed because of all the supports that are given? So is it an implementation issue? Is it a skills issue? My findings seem to suggest that it's more of an implementation issue. And so this benefit that you see in the lab, I have found with adults with and without depression histories, and also, interestingly enough, with kids who are at high risk and low risk for depression, that if they benefit and are at high risk for depression or have a history of depression themselves, in the lab, the better they do, the less on self-report measures they say that they do adaptive responses. So the more benefit I get from this laboratory task, the less I am doing good things per self-report measures. And if you get into their daily lives, what I have found is that the better they do in the lab, the longer they stay upset for when there are times of upset, which is the opposite finding for those who are healthy or maybe don't have a history of depression. The better they do in the lab, the better generally things are going, the more adaptive things they say they're doing, and the more they benefit, or at least the less protracted their dysphoria is in daily life. So it's this interesting, almost like sleeper effect, for lack of better words. We see people not being different in the laboratory setting, but yet that absence of difference is fundamentally different, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. This is maybe, I'm certain it's an overgeneralization, but if someone is, you know, is depressed or has a history of depression, and they're kind of like, they're hearing about this emotion regulation thing, and they're like thinking, well, I need to be doing more adaptive things and maybe doing less maladaptive things. But he said that the adaptive maybe doesn't always matter as much. Like, is it safe to say that if you're, you know, struggling with depression or difficult emotions, like, that maybe rather than focusing so much on the adaptive stuff, like, just stop doing the maladaptive no matter what?
Well,
as much as you're able.
I would argue that's probably the way to go. Of the two, the literature seems to suggest the maladaptive things that we do are much more depressogenic than maybe the antidepressant things that we do that are adaptive in nature. Mm-hmm. You may think about, perhaps you're doing adaptive things, and if you're doing an adaptive response, that means you're not doing a maladaptive response. So in that respect, if doing something adaptive or purportedly adaptive will help you not do something that's maladaptive, fantastic. Would you get to the same outcome if you stopped doing the maladaptive thing? Possibly, quite possibly.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe for, like we had talked about before, the people that maybe don't get depressed again after having been depressed once, maybe it's not so much that maybe there was some adaptive things going on in there, so that, like, once it, maybe the vulnerability came back for them to get depressed again, like, they were used to, maybe because they were engaging in the adaptive, used to not engaging in the maladaptive. So let's say then whatever emotional forces arose that could be, you know, signaling the onset of a depressive episode, they were just sort of maybe more aware of that and able to cope with it.
Perhaps. I think it's an interesting question. There is work conducted by Jonathan Rottenberg and, his colleague, Cashton, where they're looking at successful long-term outcomes from depression. So people who maybe have been depressed have come through their depression, but the depression wasn't this overwhelming negative event. It might have been a growing experience, and now having gone through it, they actually are better off in some ways to, in the long term, thrive. And I think that's some exciting work that's currently being developed, and is maybe less of a depressing picture of depression. And perhaps among those individuals, that's what's happening. But that's an empirical question that's probably worthy of study.
So finally, we both would like to ask you one question. Mm-hmm. Is those who are considering doing psychology for their careers, who are maybe in undergraduate, what one piece of advice would you give? And especially if they're put off by stats, what would be your advice for them?
Well, this is the same thing that, you know, I'll say to like our psych 200 students and intro to psych students and then any other, you know, student in any kind of setting, whether it's psychi or whatever. Research. I mean, that's, you know, we at CSU especially, psychology is a science, you know, and so we teach the scientific method. Our courses are entrenched in it, and we have research labs that, you know, are based in these principles. You know, we've, you know, that's basically what we've been taught. We've been talking about the science of our particular fields of emotion regulation, both in clinical and in developmental contexts. And so, regardless of what you end up doing, you know, with a psychology degree, your BA, whether it's to get a job that's psychology relevant or go on to graduate school, whether it's graduate school in a more practitioner-oriented kind of clinical context or even in a research context, regardless, research is going to be a key component to a lot of the things that you do outside of here. Being a good consumer of research is kind of, I think, essential to just, you know, any endeavor that you're going to do, whether it's buying a house, you know, buying a car, you know, choosing retirement plans, you know, having a good kind of basis and, you know, understanding data and being able to make decisions based on data is kind of a key component to a lot of things that you're going to do as an adult, whether it's, you know, in any of these kind of contexts. And so I would say being a savvy, you know, research-oriented individual is going to be good for you. So getting that exposure in any capacity that you can. And I would say, you know, not every student is going to be able to, you know, join a research lab here at CSU. Unfortunately, you know, we have about 900 majors and, you know, a limited number of faculty that have, you know, active labs that can take students on. But we have a lot of courses that are very research-focused, multiple stats courses, research methods, our psychology lab course, et cetera. Get invested in learning those things, you know. And for those students who have that stats aversion, you know, I like, and Dr. Alsosky can speak to this because he teaches stats to our graduate students. We try to think of stats less of about the math in of itself, but in terms of what you do and use it as a tool to answer questions. We have computer programs that can do the stats. I mean, it's understand the principles, you know, the mathematical principles behind it. That's good. But at the same time, it's like we, at least, you know, what I like to think of is like teaching students to use the tools, understand why you would do this particular test and what it, you know, yeah, what the outcomes of it are. The math aversion can be, you know, allied that way. So research is key. You know, the research fear can be allied by understanding that it can be very beneficial in a lot of situations for students.
So let me start out by saying I'm biased, and my bias is towards research, as Dr. Allard might have also
I tipped my hand a little bit, I guess.
Yes. Being important, and perhaps some amount of bias is present in his statement. If I were to think about one thing that I would encourage students to consider, I would encourage them to think about what do they actually want to do on a day-to-day basis. Because while I certainly think that research is great, maybe a student never wants to step into the hallowed halls of academia again. Maybe they want nothing to do with research and they want to go into the community and help the community deal with their emotional difficulties. And for those individuals, there are various pathways to get them into that more applied setting, such as, for instance, pursuing a master's in social work or mental health counseling, school psychology, and frankly, soon clinical psychology as well, because all indications suggest that there'll be accreditation for master's level clinical psychology programs, which will lead to a pathway to licensure in the United States. And so for those individuals who are interested in getting into community mental health or other such placements, maybe they don't need stats. Maybe they just need to pass and get into a master's program where they'll never take a stats class again, such as perhaps social work or mental health counseling. And that would be the best, I think, advice I can give. Think about what you want to do, because there are, I'll use the term equifinality, there are various pathways to get to the same outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to echo a little bit with that again is, and I'm not advocating that every student go out and try to join a lab, because that's not going to be possible. And not a lot of people are going to be interested in doing that as a career. It's more just the exposure. Yeah. You know, the students should be, you know, take advantage of the at least classroom opportunities to try to gain something out of that experience that they could use potentially in a practice setting, or use as a, you know, human resources manager at Progressive, you know, whatever it is that they end up doing. Because, you know, being data savvy can open up a lot of doors for you in a lot of different career paths in ways that students might not realize when they're sitting in that classroom learning about some of those principles. Yeah. So take advantage of those opportunities that we have. And this is another kind of plug for Psych 200. I mean, it's a requirement for our incoming majors and new majors, but, you know, a lot of, you know, this advice and getting exposure to a lot of the different disciplines and subdisciplines within psychology is what happens in that course, you know. And so take the opportunity to get a lot of that, because we talk about career paths, we talk about the different disciplines that we have within the psychology department at CSU. One thing when I teach the course, I actually talk about a couple additional ones, you know, that we don't cover here at CSU that might be of interest to students. So, you know, be a good consumer of all the options in order to best make that decision of what you would want to do with this type of degree.
Yeah, I think a lot of that checks out with my personal experience. I think a lot of people might be like me in that, you know, psychology was interesting just because, like, it just sounds really interesting, and I'm curious about people and then why people do what they do and, you know, how to help people and all of that. And then you run into statistics, and it's kind of like, wait a minute, why are you making me do the stats stuff? Like, I'm interested in people, like, but I, you know, it's been my experience that kind of, you know, deciding to, you know, work in a lab and take statistics, even though I wasn't totally crazy about it, but something was telling me it might be a good idea. And then, you know, kind of getting over the hump and seeing like, oh yeah, this is, yeah, this could be a really powerful tool. And, you know, maybe, and I could see how that, you know, equates to understanding people and, yeah, and can apply to many other things as well.
Sure. So as a quick plug for statistics, not that I'm biased, I would probably think that becoming an expert in statistics, even if you hate it, is probably a good thing, because the odds are if you don't like it, many others don't, which creates a niche for people who can do a good job with it, because most people would try not to learn it.
Well, yeah, I don't want to extend the interview past our final question too much, but and take up any more of your time. But, you know, that makes me think. So it's like, okay, let's say you're a psychology major, and maybe you even move on to grad school, and you do get really good at stats. I mean, is it not uncommon to see people that end up just not even working in the field because they're doing stats for somebody else in a completely different area?
Yeah,
statistics is marketable across disciplines. People who are proficient at it and can quickly grasp the fundamental concept of statistics and apply them through various softwares have a marketable skill that really can open a lot of doors.
Yeah, I mean, I have friends who have degrees in neuroscience PhDs, social psychology PhDs, developmental, that are not in academia at all. Never went into academia, and they went off into, they worked for, you know, the Gillette Shaving Company, Facebook, Google, neuromarketing firms, other kind of marketing advertising, like anything where a data analytic background was welcomed with open arms. So like that skill set can be transferred into myriad domains in other social sciences, business, economics, marketing, medical settings, med technology, biostatisticians. One of our colleagues, Dr. Rob Hurley, his wife is a biostatistician. So, like, your skill set can be transmit it to a variety of, you know, different areas that you might find some cool, kind of interesting things that you want to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess that's all. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Yes, this was fun.